Good afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we're live for an hour each weekday afternoon. You can call in during this hour and you can ask questions about the Bible or the Christian faith and we'll discuss them. You can raise a subject that you, a matter that you disagree with the host about. We can discuss that. We have an hour, pretty much of an open source, open forum. And I will give you the phone number, though as I look at the switchboard, it looks like our lines are all full. So if you call and get a busy signal, just call back, you know, make a note to have called back in 5-6 minutes and see. There, very often a line will have opened up. The number to call is 844-484-5737. That's 844-484-5737. And we will go right to the phones and talk to Joe from Oceanside, California. Joe, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Greg, I got a question for you. I love your program, by the way. Wanted to just ask you about, let me think, I think it's John 20:21 or something. I'm probably wrong about that, where it says, if all things were written, I suppose the Bible couldn't contain everything that Jesus has done. And that kind of blows my mind just because, well, not to be like Raul Reese, it just blows my mind. It's like phenomenal. And I just want to know your opinion on that, your clarification on that.
Well, actually what he says is if everything Jesus said and did was recorded, he said, I suppose the world itself could not contain the books, which
right,
is even
sorry.
More extreme. I think it's possibly a hyperbole. I mean, who knows how many books the world could contain? I mean, I've got thousands of them on my own shelf in my room, so I think I think billions of books, trillions of books would fit in the world. John is not trying to be precise. I think what he's saying is it would be an impossible task to try to document everything Jesus said or did. He was quite busy and did a lot of things, a lot more than could be recorded, and I think he's just being. I think it's just a hyperbole to say the world couldn't contain the books. There are a lot of hyperboles in the Bible. I mean, it's a way of speaking. All cultures use hyperbole, including the Hebrew culture. And I think John
right
used
on.
It. Hyperbole, you know what hyperbole is, right? Hyperbole means an exaggeration for the sake of emphasis. In other words,
right.
If a fisherman exaggerates the size of the fish that got away, we would call that lying. He's being dishonest. But many times we use exaggeration simply for emphasis, and we don't expect anyone to take us literally. We're not lying. We're simply trying to get a point across. Like if I said, you know, I think people have asked me that question on the air 1,000 times, you know, well, probably not 1,000, but I mean, to use a term like that, or 1,000,000 times, you know, to speak that way is to use what we call a hyperbole. No one expects it to be taken literally.
Right on. Can I squeeze in another question?
Sure.
Okay, one last one. I just want to know your opinion on Jehovah Jireh, which says, "Lord, I will provide," or "The Lord will provide." Just want to know your about that. That's phenomenal, and just whatever. I just want to know about it.
Well, Jehovah Jireh it comes from the story of Abraham taking Isaac up on the mount to offer him up, and Isaac said to his father, "You know, here is the fire, here's the wood, but where is the lamb for an offering?" And Abram said, "The Lord will provide himself a lamb. The Lord will provide." And after that, it says in the narrative, it says from that time on, it used to be said Jehovah Jireh, or the Lord will provide. Now, apparently, Jehovah Jireh can also be translated, "It shall be seen." So I guess there's two ways that Hebrew can be expressed, but we usually understand that the Lord will provide, and I think that fits the story best. That is simply saying that God will provide what is necessary. Now, in that story, I believe Isaac himself being offered up is a type and a shadow of Christ being offered. And when
exactly.
His father said, "The Lord will provide himself a lamb for a burnt offering," I think it is alluding to the fact that God would provide a sacrifice actually right there in the mountains of Moriah, which is also where Mount Zion was, where Jerusalem was, where Calvary was. And so essentially in the same mountain range as where Jesus was provided as a sacrifice to 2,000 years later. But what's interesting is the story, Abram said the Lord will provide for himself a ram or a lamb. And then, you know, as the story goes on, there was a lamb or a ram provided in the thicket that God provided and was offered for a sacrifice. And yet, after the story was all over, and after that ram had been provided, it says in Genesis 24 there, it says, therefore it is said to this day, the Lord will provide for himself a sacrifice. So it's like, you know, not only did Abraham's prediction come true that, you know, within a few hours of that time, maybe a few minutes of that time, even afterwards, there remained a prediction that was recognized in the time of Moses. When Moses wrote Genesis, he said, it's still today, you know, people are still saying the Lord's going to provide such a sacrifice. So it would seem that it wasn't a saying that only applied to that situation, but actually had a prophetic foreglimpse of God sending his son and providing a sacrifice.
Excellent. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
All right. I appreciate your call. Thanks for joining us. We're going to talk next to Boyd from Marysville, Washington. Boyd, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Yes. Hi, Steve. In your verse-by-verse section on the website, I was going through Matthew 17, and in 17:24, you talk about the temple tax and go, you know, some explanations on that. I don't remember ever hearing this teaching in a church, but I've heard lots and lots of teaching on tithes. And it seems to me that the temple tax would be a more genuine way to approach a church asking for money. What are your thoughts on that? Have you heard of any churches doing that kind of a method?
I'm not sure that I have. The tithe, of course, was different than the temple tax. The temple tax was like the equivalent of like 50 cents per person. It was a very small amount of a half shekel of silver was really minor gift, but everyone was supposed to offer it. Now it was not required in the law. There was indeed a half shekel tax in the law that was in the Torah that was additional to the tithe. But that half shekel tax in the Torah seems to have been a one-time thing, not a repeated thing. But I guess once the temple was built, somebody, I don't know if it was Solomon who built it or someone else after Solomon, decided that they should probably have a regular taxation. I don't know if it was every year, probably it was every year, but it was not the same as the tithe. But I don't think most churches that teach tithing would like to trade that in for a 50-cent gift once a year. So I think they'll probably still teach tithing, although it's not taught in the New Testament at all either. Neither the temple tax nor the tithe has any relevance to the New Testament. But churches do like to teach tithing because that would be a continuing income for their budget. Whereas a temple tax, if they said, oh, we should still be doing that, well, people could say, okay, I'll give you 50 cents a year if that, you know, that'll keep you happy. But I don't think it would keep them happy.
Well, it seems that they could, because churches know their budgets, they could say, you know, here's the principle of this. The temple isn't there any longer. They try to replace the temple with, you know, the church with the temple when they're asking for tithes a lot of times.
Right.
They're an example of it. But if they said, look, you know, here was the principle that happened back then, and it's voluntary, but if you understand, these are our costs. We're laying them out here for you. It's voluntary if you choose, but this would be the approximate, you know, based on our group of people that come here that would support us.
Well, the temple tax in Israel, I believe, was for the physical maintenance of the physical temple. So when things were damaged and things like that, they could be repaired. And in the New Testament, God does not dwell in temples made with hands. In fact, the temple is made up of living stones. Each of us is a component of the temple of God, of the Holy Spirit. So the temple is made of people. And so obviously, you know, if the church said, listen, we have maintenance costs here on our building, so we need to have a temple tax, for them to equate their building with the Jewish temple would be really, you know, inappropriate. Although they do that. They do that from time to time, but it would be quite easy to prove them wrong because the temple of Israel, the temple in Jerusalem, was not the equivalent of a local church building in any place, even in Jerusalem. I mean, the temple was a one building in the whole world where all the Jews came to worship. You don't have anything equivalent to that today because, again, God doesn't dwell in temples made with hands. He dwells in people. And we are living stones built into a spiritual house, Peter says in 1 Peter 2:5. So, yeah, I think that would be even harder for them to pull off than the tithing thing. I think teaching tithing in the New Testament is a manipulative thing since the New Testament doesn't teach it, and it doesn't even, you know, there's nothing in the New Testament that corresponds with the temple. You know, certainly the local church is not the New Testament counterpart of the temple. It's more like the synagogue. You know, the local church building is more like a synagogue in Jesus' day. And they didn't give their temple tax at the synagogue. They didn't pay their tithes.
Did the synagogues collect any money for their maintenance?
I don't remember how they were maintained, but no, the tithes were not used for that. They might have taken contributions for the maintenance of the synagogue buildings. Of course, the synagogue building didn't have to be anything elaborate, but they... You know, they could have had a very rough building in some cases, or met in homes, or down by the river, as they did in Philippi in Acts chapter 16. But, you know, having a synagogue building was not even mandatory. But when they did have them, they probably had some kind of agreed arrangement. I don't remember how the synagogue would have been supported, because the Old Testament never mentions synagogues. There were no synagogues in the Old Testament. So, and when Jesus came, there were synagogues all over the Roman world. But it doesn't really say how they were maintained. But they were not the equivalent of the temple. All right?
Thank you.
Thank you for your call. Let's talk to Daryl from Sacramento, California. Daryl, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Thanks very much. Could you put in context the commandment of Jesus? He said, you know, they asked a question about the love. Loving, what's the greatest law? And he said to love God with all your heart and so forth, and love your neighbors yourself. But, and the other one would be in Galatians chapter 5 about love, joy, and peace. Against such there's no law. So how do you reconcile those or put them in context?
Okay, I'm not sure there's anything that needs to be reconciled. I think both of them argue that love is our duty. And you know, when Jesus said, love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and love your neighbors yourself, he said all the law and the prophets boil down to this, or they all hang on these two commandments. And so he's basically saying the whole duty of man is to love God and to love his neighbor. Now, in Galatians 5:22, when he begins to list the fruit of the Spirit, and said the fruit of the Spirit is love, and these other ones too, joy, peace, goodness, self-control, you know, patience, and the rest. And he says, there's no law against these things. What he's saying is we don't live under the law of Moses. As long as we walk in the Spirit and are loving and gentle and self-controlled and patient and all the things that are fruit of the Spirit, we're not breaking any laws. So, in other words, we don't have to live under any law. We live in the Spirit. And as we walk in the Spirit and the fruit of the Spirit is manifested in our behavior, we end up not breaking any laws anyway. So without any thought about laws, we have, you know, we stay within all moral codes. Because if you love your neighbors, you love yourself, you won't act immorally toward him or her.
Okay, so I've heard that that when Jesus was responding to the Pharisees about the law, the greatest law, summed up, so That means that he was still under the law, and that the whole Israel was still under the law. So if the law says to love, then that would be still under the law, but we're not under the law. So what you're saying is true.
Well,
I think
we're under the law of Christ. We're not under the law of Moses. But
okay.
You see, the law of Moses had two parts. One had to do with the way you behave socially, which had to do with your moral behavior. The other part of the law had to do with the way you worship at the tabernacle or the temple, which had to do with rituals, like offering sacrifices and things like that. Now, what Jesus is saying is the moral behavior of the law, whatever God requires people to do is fulfilled when we love one another. So if I love my neighbor, I won't murder him. I won't commit adultery against him. I won't steal from him. I won't bear false witness against him, and so forth. So he's just saying that, you know, God expects people to love. And actually, 1 John chapter 4 says God is love. And so we're supposed to be like God. God made us in his image to be like him. It says in Ephesians 5:1, be imitators of God as dear children. So we're supposed to be like God. And if he is love, we're supposed to be loving. Now, that has nothing to do with the law of Moses, except that when we are loving, we happen to fulfill the moral requirements of the law. But we're not doing so with reference to those moral requirements of the law. We're doing it with reference to loving our neighbor. And it just so happens when you do love your neighbor, you don't break those laws. And that's what Paul meant when he was gave the fruit of the Spirit and said, and there's no law against this behavior. There's no law against these things. So
is that I fail to meet up to the fullest degree of love.
Well, sure. Get in line. We're all in that condition.
Okay. Well, thanks, Steve.
Sure. Yeah, we're not going to be in heaven or accepted to God because we've been perfect in love, though he wants us to be perfect in love. And it's not by our perfection that we somehow are entitled to be in a relationship with God on good terms. It's our desire to please God. It's our attempt to walk in the Spirit. It's our determination to love and our doing so to the best of our ability with his aid. That is what makes us pleasing in the way we live. We're not perfect at it, but there's a big difference in God's sight between a man who's unloving just because he never cared to be loving, on the one hand, and a man who's not as loving as he should be, even though he wants to be, but he's, you know, out of weakness or whatever, he's not as loving as he should be. Well, there's a huge difference between the one who's determining to follow God, determining to love, but falling short, and the one who has never made it his goal to love, on the other hand. One is obedient to God, one's not.
Jesus said, you know, love others as I have loved you. Mm-hmm. So therefore, that's the how of how we love is getting to know Jesus more.
Well, he set an example of us for love. He said, greater love has no man than this, than that he laid down his life for his friend. That's how he loves us, and we're supposed to love each other that way. In fact, it says that also in 1 John chapter 3, where it says, you know, herein is love. That he laid down his life for us, and we ought to lay down our lives for the brethren. So laying down our lives for the brethren, as Jesus laid down his life for us, is said to be the model of love that we're supposed to follow.
All right, thanks a lot. I appreciate that.
Okay,
God bless you.
Thanks for your call. God bless you. Richard from Seal Beach, California, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, Steve, I have a friend, and he's adamant about this law that once God says something in the Bible, it's the same all the way through the Bible. I forget the name of it, but I kind of agree with it, but I understand you don't, and I would like to hear your opinion on that law. We were reading Ezekiel 2, verse 6. Thank you, Steve. I'll listen to you on the radio. Thanks.
Okay. Well, that'd be a very hard principle to maintain, because God told Adam and Eve in Genesis 1 that they were supposed to eat vegetables, and that apparently only vegetables. And then after the flood in Genesis 9, God said, now I want you to eat every living thing, every creature shall be food for you. And then later when he made the law of Moses, he said, well, not every creature, just those that chew the cud and have a cloven hoof. And then in the New Testament it says every creature of God is good and nothing is to be refused. So we've got four different commands as you go through history. First, God tells them to be vegetarian. Then after the flood, he commands them to eat meat, every creature of God. Then when Moses comes, God commands them not to eat certain kinds of foods. And then in the New Testament, all restrictions are lifted. So, I mean, if he says, well, if God said one thing once, then it's got to be that way. Well, I mean, it seems to me that someone who makes that rule is simply making up that rule out of their own head. Why would that even be? You know, if I tell my children not to ever go out in the street without holding my hand when they're 3 years old, Does that mean that for the rest of their lives, I'm never going to change those instructions when they're old enough to cross the street without holding my hand? It's ridiculous. I mean, why would God not always have the same instructions for people, no matter what state they are in? You see, the Bible teaches in Galatians 4 that the law was a schoolmaster when we were children. And now that faith has come, we're no longer children, but we have, we have the spirit of sonship that guides us. And as we were talking to a previous caller, the spirit leads us into righteous behavior. We don't have to follow the laws of Moses. Those were for children, spiritually speaking. When people were spiritually children, they need external controls. When people are mature, they have developed internal controls. Although the standard of holiness doesn't change, the standard of morality doesn't change, certainly the rules do. There's no circumcision required in the New Testament, but it was certainly commanded in the Old Testament. In Genesis 17, God said anyone of Abraham's children that didn't get circumcised on the eighth day would be cut off from the people. That's the end of them. However, in the New Testament, Paul said, if you get circumcised, Christ will profit you nothing. You have fallen from grace, he said to these were Gentiles who were getting circumcised. So I think your friend is just not a very good Bible student. I think he's just decided if God said something once that it's always going to be on the books. And that just isn't. That's just not the way it is. So that's his mistake. All right. Let's talk to John from Vancouver, B.C. John, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for taking my call. You've touched on my story a little, my question a little bit with a couple of the other questions. Basically, it relates back to Abraham and Isaac and Abraham being very faithful to God. Under those same circumstances, I don't know that I could do the same. I mean, if I was requested to give up my life for God or sacrifice someone else's life for God, I don't think I could do that. And I'm sort of having a debate with a couple of my children who are interested in going off into the missionary field, into some dangerous places, and they seem to be quite willing to put down their lives. And I know a lot of people actually do that today, and it's a terrible thing, but I know they're doing an amazing thing for God, but I can't do it.
Well, let me ask you this. Suppose Canada went to war against, let us say, China, and your children were called into the service, and they were in the Canadian military, and they were going to be sent to China where they might possibly get killed in battle. Would you... How would you respond to that?
I would back them going. I would try and fight against it with the politicians at a different level. I would probably protest against it, but ultimately I would back.
But if you knew that some Canadians had to send their kids, would you object to being one of the Canadians who sent your kids to protect your country?
No, on that basis, I wouldn't.
Right. I mean, Christian and non-Christian parents alike often send their children off to war knowing that they could die there because they are patriotic. Now, Christians need to be even more patriotic for the kingdom of God. You know, the kingdom of God is at war, and there are people who die in the warfare against darkness as missionaries go into jungles to fight off demonic darkness. They often die there. I guess if our children died as heroes on the battlefield protecting their country, I think we'd be probably want to boast about it. We'd be proud of them. And yet we should be far more proud if our children were to die in the battle against darkness and in trying to save people's souls and promoting the kingdom of God. So missionary work is simply going to war.
I don't have a problem with that at all, and the dangers of missionary work. It was more the case where they were suggesting, okay, well, if someone said you have to denounce the Bible in order to live, it was that example. It was, if someone gets killed and you can't do anything about it, then I have to accept that. It was just where you have a choice, and you could just say, well, yeah, I'll denounce the Bible. And I know I feel terrible saying this, but
yeah,
why wouldn't you take that option but still be a follower? Is that impossible?
Well, you couldn't. You couldn't renounce Christ and still be a follower of Christ. Jesus said, he that seeks to save his life will lose it. He that loses his life for my sake will find it. You know, you're going to lose your life. Let me just make a prediction that has 100% chance of being coming true. You're going to lose your life. You're going to lose your life either for nothing or for something. Those are the only two options. You may lose your life for nothing in a car accident, or, you know, with a burglar breaking in and killing you while he's trying to rob your house, or something like that. Then you died, and you lost your life, and it was for nothing. Or you could die for God and be a martyr, be a hero. To me, the second is extremely desirable. Since I have to die for something, I'd rather die for God than for nothing or for anything else. So I think that's how you got to think about it. God bless you. I appreciate your call. We got to take a break here, but we have another half hour coming up. And so the Narrow Path is listener supported. If you go to our website, you can take anything from there for free, but you can also donate if you wish to help stay on the air. The website is thenarrowpath.com. I'll be back in 30 seconds. Don't go away.
The book of Hebrews tells us, do not forget to do good and to share with others. So let's all do good and share the Narrow Path with Steve Gregg with family and friends. When the show is over today, tell one and all to go to thenarrowpath.com, where they can study, learn, and enjoy with free topical audio teachings, blog articles, verse-by-verse teachings, and archives of all the Narrow Path radio shows. And be sure to tell them to tune into the show right here on the radio. Share listener-supported The Narrow Path with Steve Gregg. Share and do good.
Welcome back to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we're live for another half hour taking your calls. If you have questions about the Bible or the Christian faith, you can call me, and we'll talk about them. If you have a difference of opinion from the host, I'd love to talk to you about that, too. The number to call is 844-484-5737. We have, looks like a couple of lines open right now, 844-484-5737. Our next caller comes from Abby from Pope Valley, California. A lot of calls from California today. Hi, Abby. Welcome.
Mr. Gregg, good to talk with you.
Yeah.
My question, you had a caller a week and a little bit ago confused about the creation of light and dark before the creation of the sun.
Okay.
I totally missed your explanation of it, but I asked, how do you determine the length of the first 2 days?
Well, it's true. The sun and the moon and the stars were not apparently created until the fourth day. But there was day and night before that because there was light and darkness. And that's kind of explained. God said, let there be light. And there was light, and the light he called day, and the darkness he called night. It says he divided between the light and the darkness. So apparently all it takes for there to be day and night is for the earth to be turning and for the source of light to be coming from a single direction. If there's light coming from a single direction and the globe is turning, then part of the globe will be dark and the other light at any given time. And as the earth turns, the whole world will get its chance to have day and night. So when God said, let there be light, I guess we just have to assume that light was coming from a single direction, because it says that he divided that from the darkness. Now, that light, I suppose, came from himself. I don't think there was another, body in heaven, like another sun or something like that at that point. I believe that when on the fourth day, he made two lights, the greater light to rule the day and the lesser light to rule the night, it says. That's when I believe he assigned the light-bearing functions to actual created things. But, you know, at the end of the Bible, in Revelation 21, when it's talked about the new Jerusalem and the new heavens and the new earth, it says the city had no need for the sun or the moon to shine in it because the glory of God was the light of it. And I suspect maybe that's how we're supposed to understand it, that this was initially the earth didn't need the sun or the moon. It eventually God assigned a task to them, and they became the regular light bearers throughout the rest of human history. But God was able, I think, for his own glory to illuminate during the daylight hours for the side of the earth that was receiving light at that time. So, I mean, if the earth was turning at the same rate from the day that God made it until today, then there would be, and there was a source of light from day one, then there would be day and night in sequence from day one. The fact that the sun and moon became the light bearers on the fourth day only means that the source of light was handed off to other light bearers. And so, you know, that's why it was possible to have day and night even then. Right?
Mr. Gregg, I would like to talk with you again. Thank you very much.
All right. We'll look forward to your call. God bless you. All right. Let's talk to Joe from Brooklyn, New York, the other side of the country. Hi, Joe. Welcome.
Hi. Gregg, you know, like the last day, Jesus Christ said there would be famines and pestilence in one place after another. I would like to know, this COVID virus, could that be part of Bible prophecy?
Your phone kind of cracked at a moment. I didn't catch the question. I heard that you said there's going to be famines. You said there's going to be famines and stuff at the end times. What was the question then?
Yeah, quite like this COVID-19, could this be part of Bible prophecy? Like, could there be pestilence in one place after another? Could that be part of the Bible prophecy?
Well, I think if you read Matthew 24, which is the passage you're quoting from about pestilences and earthquakes and things like that, it's really not talking about the end times. I know it's popularly applied to the end times by popular teachers. But when Jesus said all of that, he followed that up in verse 34 saying, "Assuredly, I say to you, this generation will by no means pass away until all these things are fulfilled." So Jesus said that all those things he was predicting would happen in that generation. Now, there were all those things did happen in that generation. I mean, many times pastors don't tell you about that, but those things did happen in that generation. And I think that I don't think that Jesus is talking about the end times as we think of the end times. But I believe that COVID could be something that is providentially brought on the earth as a judgment, but I don't have any way of knowing if that's true. It certainly is different. It's different than most of the plagues that have come on the earth in that it's kind of spread throughout the whole planet. But it's also kind of, it looks to me like it's dying down. So I don't think it's getting worse. I don't think the Bible predicts COVID. Okay. I mean, that seems to be your question. Yeah. I don't believe there's any predictions in the Bible about COVID.
Oh, okay. Thank you. I was just curious to know if that could be part of the Bible prophecy. All right. Yeah, thank you so much.
Sure. By the way, a lot of people would give you a different answer than that, but I, you know, can I help it?
All right. Thank you so much.
All right. God bless you. Bye now. All right. Let's see here. Lamont from St. Paul, Minnesota. Welcome to the Narrow Path.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Gregg. Appreciate your program. I just have a question in regards to after Cain killed his brother.
Yeah.
And so God abandoned him to be a wanderer, and so he went to the land of Nod. And I was wondering, what is your thoughts about where did he get his wife?
Well, there were lots of people on the earth at the time that he killed Abel. They all were his siblings because all people came from Adam and Eve. But Adam and Eve were told by God to be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. Now, the first child they had was Cain, and the second one was Abel, apparently. And then, presumably, they had more children every year, probably. I mean, there are people who... my suspicion is since God wanted Adam and Eve to fill the earth with their offspring, he made them quite fertile. I mean, that'd be a big mistake on his part if he wanted them to fill the earth and then made them barren or something like that. Now, I believe that even as there are, in modern times, people who have 15 children. I know some who have 12, and I know of some in history who have had 18 and more. So, I mean, Adam and Eve lived very long. They could have had hundreds of children, actually. Now, in other words, yeah. while Cain and Abel were growing up, before Cain killed Abel, you know, they didn't kill each other as children. I mean, there's no murder as a child. Mm-hmm. How old actually were Cain and Abel when Cain killed Abel? Well, we have some clue about that in the Bible, because it says in mm-hmm. chapter 4 of Genesis, in verse 25, Adam knew his wife again. She bore a son and named him Seth. And she said, "For God has appointed me another seed for me instead of Abel, whom Cain killed." Mm-hmm. Now notice that this child was born after Cain killed Abel. And Eve yeah. saw this new son that was born as specifically as God giving her a replacement for Abel, whom Cain had killed. So I think we'd have to say this is probably the first son born to them after Cain killed Abel, because she sees mm-hmm. him as a replacement for her dead son. Now, okay, so Seth, I think we can conclude, was the first son born after the death of Abel. Now look at chapter 5 mm-hmm. of Genesis. In chapter 5 of Genesis, it says in verse 3, Adam lived 130 years and begot a son in his own likeness named Seth. Now, by the way, it also says in verse 4 that he begot sons and daughters. So Adam and Eve had sons and daughters that are not named for us. They had, I think we can assume they probably had dozens, if not hundreds, of sons and daughters. But mm-hmm. we do know that they were 130 years old when Seth was born. Yeah. That's what it says. Now, that means Cain and Abel had been growing up together, along with all their other siblings, for almost 130 years when Cain killed Abel. Yeah. And when Cain killed Abel, Seth was born. Adam and Eve were 130 years old. Seth was born as a replacement for Abel, whom Cain slew. So if Seth was the first son born after Cain slew Abel, and that seems to be implied, and if that happened when Adam and Eve were 130 years old, and if Cain was, let's just say, born when Adam was 1 year old, then there were about almost 130 years that Cain and Abel were growing up together before Cain killed Abel. And if that's so, right. he would have had probably hundreds of siblings, maybe a great deal of nieces and nephews and so forth. So when he went away and took a wife, I would simply assume he took one of his siblings or one of his nieces or something like that, because there would be a lot of people to choose from.
Right. And what about the land of Nod? What is that land?
The word Nod means wandering. Now, I think we have to assume that it was given that name after Cain went there. It says he went to the land mm-hmm. of Nod, but that's simply telling us it's like if we said, you know, Columbus sailed to America. Well, it wasn't called America when he sailed, but we call it that now. And when Moses says that Cain went to the land of Nod, I think what he's saying is he went to that land which we now know of as the land of Nod, which means of wandering. And since Cain was a wanderer, probably his wandering there is what gave it the name, the land of wandering.
Yeah.
So we don't know much about where it is. I mean, we don't have it right. on the map.
Right, right.
All right?
Well, okay, well, thank you very much. Appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you, Lamont. Good talking to you. All right, we'll talk next to Mike from Albany, Oregon. Hey, Mike, good to hear from you.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for taking my call. One of the most amazing things about your show is that it's a place where there's actually true free speech. And yeah. I think it might be like one of the last places that really does the way you let people call in and have different opinions and stuff. But yeah. I wanted to call to actually offer a different perspective today.
Okay.
From a call that you had with a guy who was bothered by needing to have a background check to work with youth.
Yeah.
And, my background, like I have a relative who was a sex offender and a church leader, and you would never have known it. I mean, you could serve alongside him for for years and you wouldn't know it. But I also worked in the criminal justice system where we would, you know, people like that would come in all the time, and they were always the most normal ones too. It was a lot of them are pretty good at hiding that. But the caller was understandably offended by the requirement, and I get where he's coming from.
Yeah.
But I think it's kind of the wrong angle to look at it, because if an institution has a general policy of doing a background check, then they're not saying that they don't trust you personally. They're sending a message really out to the sex offenders out there that they know what they're doing, they know what to look for, and they're only easy targets.
Yeah, they're also They're also meeting the requirements of the law, so you can't blame them for that either. I mean, if people are going to work with children, I think the law requires that they have a background check. By the way, I have relatives also who are sex offenders.
Yes.
So I know they exist. I also know people who whose background check would show that they did have an offense in that area, but they have not done it for decades since then. You know, and so I mean the fact
that
they. But I don't think there's anything wrong with the church knowing that. In fact, I think that a church should know that. I think my problem was this guy who called and said that the church he's been going to won't let him work with the kids unless he has a background check. I was saying this is how institutional churches have to run. I would mm-hmm. like to see churches be family enough that they know each other's background. I mean, if I had a background in being a sex offender and had repented and wasn't doing it anymore or something, I was, you know, getting involved with a fellowship of people, I'd tell them about it. I mean, at least I'd tell the leaders. I don't know if I'd announce it at a public meeting. But the point is that you know, Christians should be in fellowship with others who know them well enough to know their weaknesses, to know what their past crimes have been, and who can, you know, assess the degree of how much they want to trust them without having to go to police records. But you're right. I mean, most churches are institutions that do not know well the people who are attending them. And, you know, in that respect, they're a lot like secular institutions. And therefore, you know, the secular requirements of law in some cases probably should apply to them. So I don't disagree with you. What I was suggesting is that I disagree with the reality that most churches are like secular institutions and they don't know their brothers and their sisters. Many churches are simply too big to really know everyone there. But and frankly, people move around from church to church too, and move around from town to town. So obviously, the ideal situation doesn't exist in most cases. But the ideal situation is that a church would be like a family, where you know you're embedded in the fellowship for years, and people get to know you. And it shouldn't be so large a group that you can't get to know the people in it. But anyway, yeah, I realize that the law requires all institutions to give these background checks for people who are going to be working with children. So I wouldn't suggest that the church should break the law on that. I just think it's a shame that the churches even operate enough like corporations that the laws would even be seen to apply to them.
I agree with that aspect of it. I also think, though, that like even a small group, if they have that policy, like I would say they could have any policy they want to if they're a very small group, but if they do have that policy in place and it's a general policy, then it sends that message out to people who are trying to find these places, because all the larger organizations are doing these background checks.
That's true.
And these people are they're trying to find places of trust and
the safe place.
They're methodical about it. But the other question I have for you is like I have a friend who's a Christian in China, and he's I'm wondering if you're a Christian in a place like China, or as the United States might become more and more, where there's a lot more restrictions on things. Where would you say you should draw the line? You know, Christ is always, he was always saying, you know, be obedient even to, you know, slave masters that are, you know, that aren't kind. Just obey and be Christ-like to them. He said, you know, go 2 miles instead of one if you're asked to. But when would you say Christians should really stand up for just like civil rights and general rights in general versus just reserving kind of their clout for when governments start to impose restrictions against talking about Christ?
Well, I think that whenever the government makes rules that are outside the sphere of authority that God has ordained to the government, those rules are not authoritative, but that doesn't mean we won't ever keep them. I think Paul and Peter, both who talked about submitting to authorities, were interested in conveying the idea that we need to pick our battles. You know, I mean, there may be times when a government official doesn't really have the right to make a law, but we don't have to break it. We don't have to get into trouble with them unnecessarily or gratuitously. There are times, though, when we have to make decisions about our families, when we have to make decisions about our ministries, and where we have to just say, well, first of all, God didn't give any government the authority to stifle me from sharing Christ. I mean, they may make it illegal, but they don't have any authority from God to make it illegal, which is why, you know, the Sanhedrin, the Supreme Court of Israel, told Peter and John, don't preach in the name of Jesus anymore. And Peter, they told him twice. The first time Peter said, well, you know, if it's right in the sight of God for us to obey you instead of God, I guess you'll have to make up your mind about that. But we know what we're going to do. We're not going to stop. And then when they didn't stop, they got arrested again and they were told to stop. And Peter said, we must obey God rather than men. So, I mean, Peter understood that if we have a commission to speak for Christ, no government in the world has the authority to tell us not to do so. Now, you know, it's possible to be harmless as serpents, and I mean harmless as doves and wise as serpents, and to be cautious about being caught. I mean, that's why Christians in communist countries and even in Muslim countries often have their meetings underground. You know, they're violating the law by meeting, but they're not going to stop meeting. But they're not doing it above ground because they don't see any reason to ask for more trouble than they need. You know, I mean, if they get caught, if an informer tells on them and they go to prison or even are put to death, you know, they're willing to face that. But they're not going to go rub it in the faces of the authorities. So I think that, you know, I'm just going to do it with my life what I believe God wants me to do. If I were still raising my children, well, actually, when I was raising my children, I lived in a state that didn't allow homeschooling without governmental oversight. And my wife and I just decided we're not going to, God didn't give the government authority telling us how to raise our children. God gave us authority over our children. God commands fathers to bring their children up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. He didn't command governors and kings to bring up my children. He didn't give my children to them. He gave them to me. So we just raised our kids and homeschooled them according to our conscience. And, you know, we just kind of did it below the radar mostly, and I have no problems. I have no qualms about that. Again, the government doesn't have any authority from God to tell you how to raise your kids, unless of course you're committing criminal acts against your children. If you're, you know, molesting your children or beating your children almost to death, or, you know, if you're, you know, there are laws against battery and against rape and things like that. So obviously, the government can step in and take your kids from you, or take you to jail would be a better idea if you're doing those things. But if you're not doing any criminal activity and you're just raising your kids for Jesus and the government doesn't like it and they want to take your kids from you, well, I'd say just stay below the radar as much as you can and then suffer whatever consequences God doesn't protect you from. But God may protect you from all consequences. He did in our case. So, as far as talking to others about Christ, I think same thing goes. I mean, if it becomes illegal to tell anyone about Jesus, as it has been in some countries, and you do it anyway, and you get caught, well, then whatever you suffer, you're suffering for your faithfulness, and there's reward for it. But that doesn't mean you have to go stand on the street corner and start preaching so that you get arrested, you know, within 5 minutes.
Sure.
Yeah, you can be. Well, go ahead.
Well, my friend in China, he's it's funny because all my other friends in China who aren't Christian, they're very compliant with everything the government says. My friend who's Christian, though, he's always talking about things he's frustrated about, and I always just try to change the subject because we're always talking on an app that the government can monitor there. But I don't know, though, like, you know, I'm just wondering, like, because Christians are already kind of targeted right now in China, should I be discouraging my friend from talking about stuff that's not that he can get in trouble for that really?
I would just
doesn't matter as much.
That he needs to be cautious. You know, again, when Jesus said, "Be wise as serpents and harmless as doves," I think "wise as serpents" mainly means, you know, stay out of trouble if you can. You know, serpents will avoid a confrontation in most cases with people because most people want to kill them. So that's what I would suggest. I mean, be wise. Don't be foolish. On the other hand, there are people who they feel God's told them to go out there and preach publicly, and they're going to, I mean, I'm on the radio, I'm in the public, you know, if it became illegal to be a Christian on the radio and talk about the Bible, I guess I'd probably have to get arrested. But, you know, not everyone is called to do that publicly, and it is possible to maneuver, you know, below the sight line of the government in many ways. Not as much as it used to be. I mean, certainly we got almost universal surveillance now. You can hardly, use anything online or use your cell phone or go anywhere without being on camera. So, I mean, time may come when we just have to say, oh, well, they're going to arrest me. Maybe they'll kill me. That's okay.
Yeah.
But you're raising small kids. When you're raising small kids, try to stay out of trouble if you can.
Yep. I try to do that. Well, I appreciate your show, Steve. God bless
you. Mike.
Thank you for taking my call.
All right. God bless. Bye now. Dennis from Hillsboro, Oregon. Welcome to The Narrow Path.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. I'll be quick. There's somebody I was listening to on the radio that he shares a lot of political facts, and that part's good, but he's always making fun of the Democrats and telling us that no Democrat will go to heaven and calling like Nasty Pelosi. I don't think that he tries to justify this in the Bible. I don't think there's any justification for bullying even your enemy that you can find in the Bible. Would you agree?
Well, the Bible, Jesus said, bless those who curse you and do good to those who persecute you. Though the truth is, Jesus even referred to Herod as that fox. And John the Baptist rebuked Herod to his face and said that he was committing adultery with his brother's wife and so forth. And it says in Luke chapter 3 that John the Baptist not only confronted Herod about that, but about all the evil things that Herod did. So there is a line there that has to be walked carefully. You don't just want to be abusive toward evil people or toward people who you disagree with. And I do think, I don't think it helps the cause of Christ when Christians just use gratuitously, insulting nicknames for people. I mean, I think we can stand against what they say and what they do, and we can say why we do. But just to, it seems a little childish to me to use nicknames that are insulting nicknames. It doesn't accomplish anything. It just is, it's just your way of saying, it's like you're preaching to the choir. Those people who agree with you, you're saying, hey, I've got my credentials as a conservative because I call Nancy Pelosi Nasty Pelosi. You know, I mean, it's not going to change anything Nancy Pelosi does to call her that. It's not going to even change anything any Democrat does. So I'm not sure why that would be considered to be a good thing to do. When I don't think it's going to change your enemy, and it's just going to my mind, it's just a matter of kind of saying, I belong to this anti-establishment, anti-democratic group. And I don't see that as helpful myself. I don't think it helps Trump at all. I think Trump would have been a lot more popular if he had abstained from that kind of thing, because he did a lot of things that we can approve of, but a lot of things that came out of his mouth were not very, they're a little embarrassing for people who supported him. Hey, I'm out of time. Thanks for your call. You've been listening to The Narrow Path. We are listener supported. Our address is The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. Our website is thenarrowpath.com. Tune in again tomorrow and we'll continue our discussion. God bless you.